And we are back. Black and a Half, episode number 101. We're in triple digits now. My name is Silas Lindenstein. Thank you so much for joining me today. Today, I got two more remote quarantine guests. Returning favorite, Joseph Greenhour.
Hello.
All right. And all the way from San Antonio, Texas, my best friend from college, my best man in my OG wedding, Hector Garza, Professor Hector Garza. Wait, is it Dr. Garza?
No, not yet.
Not yet?
I'm getting...
Okay. You're getting to it. Almost there. hey, Tui, thank you so much for coming on today. Really appreciated the conversation that we're about to have. People know the secret here. It was awesome. This episode, we got to talk about, we pontificated about the quarantine that we're into, about the socioeconomic attitudes about it all. We talked about art and its place in life and in quarantine and its future. A lot of fun stuff. I think you'll enjoy it. A lot of good theater talk too. Appreciate the theater talk. I love recording on Zoom because I'll look over at you on the screen, even though you're not really there. Like, I'm like, oh, that's you. Oh no, I should just look at the camera because that's. That's you, but you're on my screen over there. It's very confusing. It's I don't know about you guys, but I feel this weird. Have you done a lot of Zoom? Have you all done a lot of Zoom conversations?
You know, my kid's done more Zoom than I have because that was one of the first things that's how I figured out the whole Zoom was for my kid had a lunch play date with all of his classmates, and he's meeting with his teacher, and his teacher's meeting with the like small chunks of kids in the class. Over Zoom, and I think she's kind of giving the same lesson a few times a day through smaller kids through the online thing.
I feel like I've seen so many people now, I've also not felt as disconnected. Like, I'm seeing more faces of people, but I'm like, but I can't hug you or say hi or shake your hand.
We never hugged.
Well, not yeah. I didn't know what I was missing out on.
It's not like we were like just every time I saw you, just like.
But I could. But I could.
Not that we didn't hug. I mean, we've hugged.
I knew I could. If I had known the last time I saw you,
I'll give you a hug.
Who knows where my hands would have gone if I knew.
Yeah,
last person I could touch.
I'll give you a good hug.
Okay, well, it's all as long as I see your test result first. Okay, make sure when we show our badges that show we're COVID clear. When we scan our wrists after they put the RF chip in us with the vaccination, it's some good conspiracy. Okay, so here we are, Black and a Half, episode number 101, Hector Garza.
Stand by to receive our transmission. Stand by to receive our transmission. Stand by, stand by. Join us. Live long and prosper.
So I hurt my back yesterday. I just posted about it. and it's not like the old, it's not, you know, we're all hurting our backs now and stuff, right? Because we reach for a fork or whatever. But this was legitimate yard work that I was doing, and it kind of hurt. And then somewhere in the middle of the night, it seized, and I was just like rolling over, and I'd never been in so much pain. And I flailed my arms, and I hit my wife in the crotch and woke her up. Like, she woke up with a pow, right? Like, I didn't mean to. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. I'm in pain. And it's age, man. I don't like I did fall last week, and I don't know if that set it up, but.
Did you have a fall, Silas?
I had a fall.
It's when you get older, you don't fall. You have a fall.
Oh, no. I was moving the yard waste bin. It was open, and I was just pushing it, but we'd been putting a lot of stuff in it, and it was back weighted or something, and it flew down fast, and it just brought me with it. My head went into the yard waste. So it would have been more comical if I wasn't excruciatingly in pain. Like I hurt my hand, landed on my side. And I don't know if that also set it up, but I was like almost crying because it hurt so bad. But I was also kind of like, my God, that would have been so funny if someone saw it, man. It was
the laugh you lost. You went through the pain, didn't even have the laugh.
That's what I'm saying. Because everyone's quarantined. Nobody's watching me.
Yeah, the only jokes you get to do now are the ones you do for yourself.
Yeah. it's rough. Like my job is kind of canceled right now. I mean, there are people working. If you had clients, or I think the corporate companies, they have clients, so they're not having an issue. But Joe, you're working.
I'm working, but I'm not making money. It's right. Weird.
You have to grow.
My job is a long timeline anyway.
Hector, Joe, you don't know. Hector doesn't know what you do. He's we call him the Orchid King of Seattle. He grows orchids for. He owns Emerald City Orchids, and it's funny. I tell people that, and sometimes they nod. They're like, "Okay, that's a job. Like you grow orchids, right?
Yeah. What is that?
There's a lot of money in that.
Do a lot of work. Like I'm doing a lot of work now. I'm planning on potting up a lot of plants, and that stuff won't be for sale for like another 18 to 24 months. But if I do the work now, it'll be ready then. So I'm just, you know, it's weird. I'm like not able to do the immediate sales. So I'm kind of just doing all this other hard work to invest in the future.
So what about all your flowers blooming right now?
They're eating shit. It's like I'm sitting in a paradise of flowers. I'm the only one that sees it. I can't sell any of them.
But they won't die, right?
The plants won't die, but the flowers, they don't last forever.
You can coax them back though, right?
Yeah, I just gotta wait till this time next year.
Next year,
you know. So it's like if I had my shows, one thing that really burns is I did a show and there was this outfit there that kind of got clipped on Valentine's Day. They had all this extra Valentine's inventory, and it was like after Valentine's Day in February. So I got this smoking hot deal on all these plants. I was going to sell these things for so much money and make a killing plant. But I got so many of them. I'm like, I got them so cheap, but I got so many. Check it out. I'm going to just crush with these things. And then I did one show after that, and then everything was canceled.
Yeah.
And now I have this greenhouse just full of these beautiful flowering plants. And I'm not like that upset because, yeah, I'm going to lose a little money, but. But how many of them I got, I did get them awfully cheap, and they are pretty to look at. I don't mind looking at them.
And in 2 or 3 years, when the quarantine's over, you'll be able to sell them.
But it all, yeah. But in 2017, when Trump dies in office, we will be able to leave our homes again.
But then, heck,
how long have you guys been quarantined?
Jesus. It's been a month, right?
Has it been a month?
I think it's been a month. Well, actually, I think it's been a month since he declared a national emergency. Yeah. But like, because we closed before a lot of other things did.
So you guys have been closed longer than a lot of people.
Yeah. Oh, it's exhausting. And I was like, I knew what was going down before most people. And so I was already locking up. Like I was like, I'm not going out. So I wasn't going out very much until like San Francisco locked down before we did. But I was like, the second they did the lockdown, that's when I went and did all my hoard buying. I was like, no, everyone's going to hear about it and they're going to buy everything. We got to go now. Go get our stuff. Get our toilet paper.
Did you get it?
I did.
I had enough toilet paper in my house. I'm like, wait, what are you guys doing? And you're like, who's cutting it this close? Who's cutting it so close that they gotta like
I did not buy
years worth of toilet paper?
I will tell you, I did not know how much toilet paper I used until I got a bidet. And it's more the lack of, like, I just see that we still have all this toilet paper. And I was like, oh, we went through this before. Like, this is a lot. We still have a lot now. I
went to Franmeyer. They had a limit three. I bought one thing of toilet paper. And then I was like, I didn't go to the store for a couple weeks. And then I went back and they had toilet paper in limit three. And I was like, I haven't even opened the other one, but I'll get it.
Hector, are you are you're teaching still? Are you still teaching?
I don't teach anymore. I'm the chair of the department. So
you're Randy?
Yeah, pretty much.
They don't make you teach a class?
I can if I want to, but if I taught a class, then one of my adjuncts wouldn't have had a job, so I just gave the class up to her because it's extra money. So no, we're not obligated to teach. All we have to do is we do our 8 to 5 every day. And if we did teach, I'd either have to teach online or have to teach outside of hours.
Yeah,
outside of the 8 to 5. So I don't teach. Next semester I will teach because we're getting we're adding a script analysis class to our curriculum, and there's no way I'm not teaching that class. So I'll teach that next semester or in the spring. We haven't figured out when it's going to get scheduled. But I work full time. I mean, I'm still working, still getting paid. They just sent me home. They sent me home with my computer and all my files, and I sit here and answer questions all freaking day long. Like, I just sent an email and it's like 10 o'clock at night. So
is that what you did before?
Like, no, not really, actually, because, you know, it's like I was talking to my boss about it today because we were, you know, when you work 8 to 5, when you leave at 5, and if somebody sends you an email, you're like, I'll answer this email tomorrow when I'm at my office where I have the information. Well, now I have the information all the time, so I kind of feel obligated.
Yeah.
But I do. It's just weird, you know?
Yeah, you work from home and then you're always working. You're
that's it. Yeah.
You're always working.
Yeah. It's very weird. It's a very weird feeling. And the other thing, I kind of feel a little guilty about not working because, like, all my professors, all the professors that work in my department, and I'm like in charge of like 40 faculty, are just complaining about how much work they have. And I'm like, yeah, it sucks to be you, you know? teaching a class face-to-face requires an hour and 15 minutes twice a week. Doing that same class remotely is like 7 hours a day.
Really?
Because think about an art class.
Yeah.
Where a faculty member can be up in front of people and show a technique and the students are there to follow it, right?
Yeah.
Well, now they have to do that technique, record it, make sure that everything's so, instead of just doing it, they have to plan ahead of time. So it's taking a lot longer for them to. So it's taking like 3 hours to paint something that it would have taken an hour and 15 minutes because talking about it is a lot easier than actually doing it and demonstrating it out. So the faculty, and then I have some faculty that are like going above and beyond, which I appreciate. But it's like, you know, it's almost like I want to tell them, you know, you don't have to do so much. Like, I have one faculty member who's doing like stop motion animation. Like, she's freaking taking a picture of a paint stroke, and then she does another paint stroke and takes another picture of it. And I'm like, dude, just record yourself doing it. I don't understand this. Oh, but it looks so much. I'm like, you do you, man. Do whatever you're going to do. But I'm telling you, you're doing more work than you need to, you know?
Have you told any of them, like, man, I wish you worked this hard normally?
I haven't said it to them, but, you know, sometimes I do think it. Yeah.
It's I gotta think it's weird though, because I mean you're the theater chair, right?
I'm in charge of 5 disciplines. So it's art, dance, music, speech, and drama.
Well, okay, when we were in college together, did you ever think to yourself, one day I'm going to be charged in charge of a dance program? I'm going to.
Never. Never. And you know, the funny part is even when I was the lead in theater, I was in charge of dance because we don't have a full-time dance instructor. We've been trying to build a program there. So I've been like the lead in dance for the last 5 years. And well, you know me, I have two left feet. So, but the cool part of it is I've gotten to hire a lot of cool people. It's just nobody wants to stick around for a part-time job. You know, yeah. That's the thing that sucks the most about this job is I work at a junior college and we go about 50-50 full-timers to adjuncts, and adjuncts, they don't stick around because it's not worth it for them, you know?
Yeah. And Joe, you know.
So it takes them on to the next job? Is it like a stepping stone position? Is that why?
It is. Like I've had two drama faculty come through here, be adjuncts for me, and then have moved on to full-time jobs somewhere else. So yeah, we are a stepping stone. Unless you get one of the full-time gigs, and then people stay here forever once they have the full-time gig. Because there's no tenure, but there's also no real way to lose your job unless you do some really pretty bad shit, you know?
And Joe, I met Hector. Hector's lost a lot of... There's a lot less of Hector than when I knew him, right?
A lot less.
So, like, you listen, I mean, I can't tell from this thing. I love you guys when I do Zoom and everyone has, like, the phone by their crotch. So it's like, like, I have this look like, ah, I remember this. I used to be an actor.
Yeah.
So I used to get cast.
Yeah.
But what did you lose at the most when you did?
Well, the highest weight, this is gonna blow you away. The highest weight that I ever recorded was in a doctor's office was 390. And that was after I had already lost about 40 pounds.
Okay.
So I'm estimating that my heaviest weight was somewhere between 425 and 450, right in that range. And right now I'm at 290. So I'm about 125 to 150 pounds lighter than I was at my heaviest. And you've known me at my heaviest because that's when I was in the 400s when I knew you.
You've lost all my children.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like it's as if all my children right now were on top of me.
Yeah. You know, I do CrossFit and they did a workout for me when I lost 100 pounds. And the funny part is they made me carry around 100 pounds as part of that workout.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that. And, you know, it's distributed different than, you know, when you put a dumbbell or a barbell on your back with 100 pounds on it.
Same thing.
It's very different than all over your body. But, yeah, it you can feel it in that moment, you know.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, when a doctor tells you that you have diabetes, well, that's a funny story, actually. I went in for some issues that I was having, and I kind of speculated that I was diabetic. But I have, you know, I'm a typical male. I don't like to go to the doctor. I like to ignore shit as long as possible.
Yeah.
But I remember when the nurse that pricked my finger and took my blood sugar, and she looks at the meter, and she went like this. She went, and I was like, is it high? And she just looked at me and my blood sugar was in the 400s.
I don't know what that means.
600, you go into a diabetic coma.
Wow.
Normal is about 100. Normal blood sugar for somebody that's not diabetic is about 100 when you're fasting, right? And that's when they took it. So I was at 430 something. And yeah, it was a pretty scary moment. And the funny thing is they took your A1C is actually measured over time, and it's measured 13 is the highest that it measures. And when my labs came back, it said greater than 13. So yeah, it was a pretty sobering moment, and it kind of wakes you up a little bit. And that's when I decided to take control and do some stuff, you know?
Yeah. I think there was a few years ago I was having, like, it's right before I got married. I was having some weird breathing issue, and I don't know if it was related to end up getting pneumonia, but like they were, because they checked for pneumonia, I didn't have it, and I just like, I was just felt like I was having trouble getting my breath a lot, and they sent me to this guy to, it wasn't like a doctor, it was something else, but I had to like breathe into a tube and hold it and do these tests, and I was like explaining to him what I was feeling. He's like, well, you know, you got a little girth there, so that might be. I was like, what the fuck? Girth? What the fuck? Girth? Who the fuck are you? Tell me I got a girth. It's like, oh, I got a little weight, but I'm not girth.
Yeah.
My biggest sobering years ago was when I I've told the story on stage a bit while ago, but was when I went to the doctor and they because I was having pains. So a weird pains in my side, and they it was so for 48 hours or whatever it took, like when they sent me to do a CAT scan or an MRI, and they said, oh well, there's like a tumor in your liver, and I was just like, fuck. And it's like, you have a fatty liver and there's a tumor, and so we're gonna have it checked out. And then it turned out to be benign, but
yeah,
it was like, but you got a fatty liver, and you're like, well, you gotta work on that. That was a sobering,
yeah,
and how I was able just to, that was a light switch where I went to the gym that day, I mm-hmm. stopped eating everything, stopped drinking, stopped everything, like just, oh no, that's what I just needed that, and that kicked me in the butt. And so for a good year and a half, lost a ton of weight.
Hector, you mentioned you do CrossFit, but they also, you know, diet and exercise. Did you do anything special for your diet?
Yeah, I did exactly what Silas was talking about. I stopped eating like a madman. You know, I got an app, and the first thing that my doctor said is, you know what, just figure out how many calories you're eating in a day, and then, you know, cut that down a little bit at a time, and you'll be okay. And I remember putting my normal day into a calculator that told me how many calories I was eating, and I was eating somewhere around 5,000 calories a day. Unnecessarily. I mean, I was eating breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Like, you know, you're supposed to have three square meals, right? Well, my meals are a little more than square. So the sobering moment where I look at this calculator that's added up all the calories that I ate that day, and it was somewhere in the $5,000 or 5,000 calorie range. To add a pound, it is eating through was like, oh, I don't even remember the math, but I remember just thinking to myself that I was probably, if I had continued to do that, I was going to continue to put on a pound a week, indefinitely, you know, and that's what I was doing. So, and as soon as I cut that down, I mean, I was like, I remember from my reading of my A1C being above 13 or greater than 13, 8 months later, I had lost 80 pounds. So I lost about 10 pounds a month. And I've been kind of continuing that. I plateau every once in a while, and I still yo-yo a little bit. But when I went to the doctor 8 months later, I was no longer diabetic, and it was because of the 80-pound loss that I had. And well, I wasn't even, you know, it was like, and I wasn't going, you know, to pizza buffet, which is like my favorite.
Yeah.
You
know? Wow. Mm-hmm. I might have had another sobering thing today, actually, was
the back.
Well, it wasn't just the back. It was like, so I fell asleep on the couch since I was up. I was up a lot last night. And my wife started taking a video because I had fallen asleep on the couch, and my son was kind of playing with me like while I was sleeping, because he thought I was messing around with him. Like, he thought I was doing fake snoring. Like, but I was doing real snore, like I was really asleep, and my wife's showing me, and I was like, is that how loud I normally am? And she's like, no, you're louder than that normally. I was like,
yeah.
And I was like, oh my god, that's
yeah
horrible. Why do you sleep in the same bed as me? I'm thinking, I was like, wow, yeah. I knew like I snored, but I didn't, I don't think it, no one's ever recorded it. And she wasn't even recording it to show.
One of those like terror, I can't breathe kind of things where you're like, stop.
I haven't, but she said that she thinks that she's heard me like stop like for a second and breathe suddenly. And I'm like yeah. I don't know. I'm fine. Whatever.
Yeah. No, yeah, I mean, I had the same thing. Rebecca used to, I stopped snoring after now that I'm under 300 pounds, I don't snore anymore.
If I don't drink, I stop snoring.
Yeah.
Drinking is a big one. If you drink, it dries out your sinuses.
Yeah, relaxes my uvula in back. Just like one, if I'm plenty hydrated and I just have like a glass of wine too late at night, it just relaxes and I can feel myself not sleep as well. Like, that's how weak I am as a person. Is I'm not even an alcoholic. It's just like I just want it because it's cold and not water, right? And but I'm like, I know I sleep better if I don't drink. But she won't stop. So I try to not buy it, and then she'll bring home a case. And I'm like, wow. Like
the six pack of wine.
Yeah, six bottles. It's the same. I like a lot of the foods. Like, if we didn't have in the house, I would probably just eat the strawberries and bananas and stuff. But they bring it in, and then the drama is once I give in and I start eating some of it, then I'm like out of the store. I'm like, oh, I should pick up. You know, the kids would really enjoy this.
Yeah, that's always, there's a pitfall with the kids, and then yeah, you make a lot of, I find that if I'm trying to eat healthier, the decisions I make at the store are really the ones that make the difference, because, you know, if I buy a little thing that, I'll just have this once in a while, and that's what I'm going to eat until next time.
The first time I did Whole30, I loved it. Like, I hated it, but I loved it because I never tasted fruit before and felt like it was amazing. Like, it was so like, oh my god, this banana is so sweet. This is like the sweetest thing I've ever had, this banana.
Oh, there's something about fruit and vegetable, like if you get into it and you know what a carrot's supposed to taste like, and then you have a really carrot
like butter, right? It's supposed to taste like butter and brown sugar. Yeah, is that
like what carrot flavor, and if you have a carrot that tastes like very carroty, then you're like, this is the best carrot. Oh, you have a tomato. Oh, it's so sweet and tastes just like a tomato supposed to taste. How to get tomato? You can't taste them. A lot of stuff you buy at the store now has no taste. Like apples have no taste, and tomatoes have no taste. They have a texture with no taste. Like, there's juice in there, but it doesn't taste like anything.
Yeah.
I know it sounds dumb, but my like the vegetables I grow in my backyard last year, that was amazing to me. Like, I was like, I've never tasted... Like, I never thought I would buy zucchini. I would never buy zucchini from the store and just bring it home and just eat it, like, without cooking it. Like, but zucchini from my yard tastes amazing.
Anything from your yard is going to taste
good. It's so clean.
Homegrown is the best. Homegrown is the best produce you can have. Vine ripened. Anything that ripens on the vine at your home.
Oh.
Especially, I mean, even if it tastes like shit, you grow. It's going to taste so good, you know?
That's true.
It's like an advertisement y'all are having for Victory Gardens, man.
Victory Gardens? Wait, what's that? Is that a...
That's a thing from World War II, man.
I don't know that.
People grew their own fruit or grew their own vegetables because there was shortages everywhere.
Oh.
So people had gardens in their backyards and they called them Victory Gardens.
Oh, was that in a play? Is that how you know that?
I got so much use. Yeah, it's probably.
That was the best thing about theater. Theater taught me so many useless little things that somebody stuck in a play and turned out it was real life, or having to research for a play and go, no, this is actually a tradition in this area. Yeah. Everyone plays the xylophone, and it's just what you do for Christmas.
Yeah, because every once in a while I'll come up with something like that, and Rebecca will look at me and be like, for a play, man. How else do I know anything? Because you know? I was doing it at math, man. I've directed like close to 100 plays now in my career.
Yeah,
getting there.
Yeah.
You're pro level. Wait, you've got your 10,000 hours, right?
I've done my 10,000 hours. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
I was there when Hector started. I was his inspiration. I like to think
you were the reason I got started. I always, when I tell the story, people ask me how I got into theater and how I got into directing. I always tell the story of you and your encouragement, and I'm not just blowing smoke. That's absolutely true.
It's so
like funny. I tell my students always ask me, "Why'd you get into theater?" And I tell them the story. Directing class and how you encouraged me, and how I just remember that one moment where you said, "Oh yeah, people are talking about you. They say you're good at this." And I was like, "What? I'm good at this?" And that was like one of those moments in your life, you know?
Yeah.
Where you back on it and you're like, "That was a pivotal moment in my life. That was a pivotal moment in my life."
And you know, I still, when I see somebody with now, I'll still say something to them. But then sometimes people piss me off because they get pissed at me because I don't book them because I don't feel that way. And I'm not, you know, I disappointed way less people in theater, I feel like. Because there was less roles.
Well, no, but I think it's easy to help people in the theater. You know, I think there's so few people that their parents let them do it, you know?
Yeah.
And so you need people. I mean, when I got here, I was begging people to be in the show that I was trying to direct, you know? And cut to 2 years later, and all of a sudden I had an audition where I had to tell people that they didn't have a role, and it felt weird, you know, where before I was like scrounging for people, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, that's funny because that's how I got my first role. My first role I didn't audition for was Big Six in City of Angels. Yeah. And you know, I remember Bill coming into the green room, and he's like, "Hey, I need you." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "I have a character that's a big character, that's a big mountain of a man, and you're a big mountain of a man." So that's how he pitched it to me. Yeah. And I was like, "Ah,
that's awesome."
Yeah,
it's never one of my things that led me away from theater for a while was just the fact that there was no roles really for me.
Yeah.
Like, and so once I was out of college, like, I was like, well, I have to direct because I can't be in anything because people are just going to book who they imagine in it, who at the time was just white people. That's what they imagined, even though it's funny being a real progressive city where they talk about you can't look at blind casting, just cast anybody. And I'm like, I don't know. I was like, oh, yeah, 20 years ago, you sure in the fuck didn't think that?
Yeah, right. Not even in just blind casting, the roles that were available for non-whites there was nothing. It was nothing out there. And now, I mean, there's more now, but it's still a problem. I mean, you still look at all these theaters, just look at all the regional theaters and what they're doing, and they're still doing dead white guy things. Huh?
Yeah. Well,
and when they do a play by a Latinx or a African American or a lesbian, it's like fanfare. Oh, look what we're doing! Look how freaking progressive we are! And it's not even a fucking production; it's a fucking stage reading. You're like, what progressive are you if the only freaking play of color in your whole season is a fucking stage reading that has like one show? I mean, how progressive really is that? You know?
Yeah,
and that happens so much. I mean, you know,
I want to see when they eventually will, because I noticed even more minutia now, right? Like, okay, Mixed Dish, that TV show. Have you seen it?
I haven't, but yeah, I know what you're talking about.
When I saw that was the first time I've ever watched a show ever, and I didn't realize it till it happened. When I watched it, I was like, this show's about me.
Yeah.
I've never seen this before. Like, it was mind boggling and I didn't know I had missed anything. But I noticed when I audition for roles, they will book me, and I'm not dark, you know, since I'm not black, they don't book me. They will put me with a white woman or a woman of any other color or a black woman, but they will never book me with a light skinned black. I'm never paired up in an audition with another light-skinned woman.
Right.
They want to, they're like, okay, if we got one confusing guy, we need the other person to be clear. Yeah.
They're clear.
We got to.
Ambiguity in both.
Yeah, you can't waste all that diversity on one couple. Spread it out. Like, if you got a cast, you got to spread that diversity out. You can't just have the one scene.
But really, I say go look. Like, if you when you watch a show, I don't think you'll ever see a movie or a show or a commercial with two light-skinned people.
Here's what's happening a lot. I don't know if you've noticed, like, commercials and even, well, mostly in commercials where they'll have an interracial couple. The kids of those interracial couple, that's where they're casting people like you. Yeah. You're just too old.
I know. Yeah. Yeah.
Too old.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Remember, when I started college, that was still a time that people were still upset at interracial relationships, like, openly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not just that. I mean, well, there was a couple of years ago when the Cheerios commercial where they had an interracial couple.
Yeah.
This was years ago. Yeah. The funny part is I worked with her. I directed her in when I lived in Boston in a 10-minute play.
The mom.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So it was, she's white as could be, and she was her husband was black, and they had the little mixed-ish baby. That was 2 years ago, and there was an uproar about that.
That's true. Throwing it in their faces.
Yeah.
Why are we throwing that progressive agenda of mixed Cheerios?
I don't know. It's weird. Some people still don't get it. I mean, I got a mixed race kid, and like when I go to the airport, people are like, "Did you steal that baby? Whose baby is this?" I'm like, "This is my fucking kid. I made this kid."
You know, have you been questioned if he's yours?
Not overtly. They haven't been like, "Is this your kid?" But then there's been like the extra security questions. They're like, "Is this your daddy? Who's this guy?" You know. Yeah. And I'm like, "Fuck you! You didn't ask the white lady in front of me with those little blonde kids. Those were her." I didn't see you asking them if that was their mom.
Yeah. No, I had a cashier at Fred Meyer ask me. He just goes, is that your son? I'm like, yeah. And I was really, like, I was bothered by it more because.
Oh, thank you, Fred Meyer guy. Are you here to protect all the children?
Also, he was an Asian gentleman. English is a second language, right? And his tag said John. And I'm like, you're not fucking John. I'll tell you that. I know that. I may not know a lot of things. Your name is not John. So don't question me on my child.
I want to talk to John. Where's John? John back here.
Where's the body? Quarantine though. Hector, how are they down there? Are people behaving in your city?
No, you know, well, it's a little, you know, the funny part is our Texas was one of the last, the governor for Texas was one of the last ones to close down the whole state. But the weirdest thing about Texas is that we're very firmly a red state, but all the cities are very progressive. So yeah. Austin has a Democratic mayor, San Antonio has a Democratic mayor. And, so interestingly enough, here what happened was all the cities, all the mayors, like shut it down. But that's the biggest problem for us is we're sitting here in Bexar County, San Antonio, and then all the little podunky kind of cities and counties outside of us are still saying, "Oh, it's a hoax. It's not happening." So. We have, like, seriously, people on the news saying this is bullshit. It's not true. It's the Democrats. And really, the only – when all is said and done, going on between Kentucky and Tennessee, where one of them has a Democratic governor and one of them has a Republican, and you're seeing the explosion amongst the Republicans, I think that's what's going to play out here in Texas too. So we're going to have a really severe bump. And we're going to have a really severe, like, uptick in cases and deaths, but it's all going to be in the rural areas, in the rural counties.
You know what's weird? I don't get this whole thing with the Republicans. Like, talking about how it's a hoax and everything like that. And it's like, you're killing your own base.
That's what he's doing for you.
Like, what are you? They gerrymandered all these districts so that they win by like the slimmest margin in all these districts across the nation. And then they're going to kill off that 1% margin of people to win these places.
Well, what Oscar said,
that's probably 25 to 30% of the actual voters in America believe what these guys believe. They have an outweighted voice. But if they do this, they're really going to screw up their own cheating mechanism.
I just don't understand how you're watching video from Italy and they're driving trucks of bodies down the street and they're like, obviously this is trying to bring Trump down.
Yeah. I think the problem is you're assuming rednecks are watching videos of anything happening in Italy.
Right, yeah.
The thing that strikes me is how little publicity is going on with the trucks being loaded with bodies in New York. There's a truck out back.
Yeah.
Stacked body bags. And then the other one is those caskets that were all buried. It was the first mass grave that I think that we've seen in modern times here. You know, that's an image we see in other countries, in third world countries. And this is a freaking cemetery in New York City being freaking white coffins being put next to each other in a mass grave. And to me, it baffles me why that's not a bigger deal, why that's not a bigger deal.
They also had that picture where they were digging those graves using prison labor, not giving those guys any protective gear.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you got them out there burying the plague victims and you don't even give them a freaking mask? I mean, come on. Like, what's going on here? This is some bullshit.
I remember it was like a week ago that somebody had tweeted that we were days, if not maybe a week or so, away from arguing the semantics online of what constitutes a mass grave.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because people will be saying, well, it wasn't a mass grave. No, no, no. To qualify as mass, you have to have 500 within a, like, it's, I mean, it's weird because I feel like in Washington, now I'm starting to feel conspiracy-ish because I feel like the numbers are too low in Washington for what my wife sees, my wife hears from other people. And so I'm like, I was like, is Inslee lowering the numbers so that Trump doesn't get too mad and this will stop funding or whatever? And now that funding's been pulled, that he's literally like, okay, screw you.
But I think that's one of the reasons why they did not put out a lot of tests, because they didn't want the test numbers to come back as all these people being infected and having all these positives. They don't want people to know what's going on. They don't. That's why they don't have the test.
Yeah.
But that's going on here. The only way that it's going to get stopped.
That's what's going on here in Texas, man. Here, our numbers are low. The number of positives, low. Number of deaths, kind of undetermined. But it's because, not because they're not here, it's because nobody here in Texas is being tested. Rebecca has a student who's had a fever for a week. And she worked she works in the health industry. She's had a fever for a week and can't get a test.
No, because do they need two out of five symptoms, or
I think it's higher. I think in Texas we don't have any tests, so it's like even the threshold is even higher here to get a test.
I have a friend whose roommate totally had it and took her to the hospital, and she's like, "Yeah, you guys got to test her. She's got it." And they're like, "No, we're not going to do it." No.
Yeah,
and so okay.
the numbers out of New York are skewed though, because this is. In a normal day, which seems high to me anyway, in a normal day, the NYPD pulls 25 dead bodies out of homes on a daily basis, 25. And that number has ticked up to, not ticked up, has exploded to 200.
Yeah.
And many of those people are dying of the virus, but because the tests are so necessary for live patients.
Yeah. They stop.
They're not testing who's dying. So the numbers are going to be off completely.
Well, and
it's way worse. It's way worse than they're telling everybody pretty much everywhere.
I've got some inside baseball intel potentially of there's apparently a study that's not being really public. It's not public right now. Is that at least here in Washington, we're getting like a 30% fail rate on negative tests.
Yeah.
So there's like 30% of the people have it and they don't think they do.
30% of the people test it.
Yeah. They're negative. Yeah, they do. But then, so the problem is also if that person gets tested negative and then dies, they're not going to count.
Yeah.
Then they just had a regular heart attack.
So I'm looking at mass grave, and the first thing that came out was Wikipedia.
Yeah.
And all it says is multiple human corpses.
Yeah.
So multiple means what? More than one?
And so, the argument from the right will be when someone says, oh, people want to say mass grave, but that's only two people, you know?
Right.
That's... It doesn't. They're setting this up as a big thing.
We know it's more than two. Yeah, I know. But it's also It doesn't have to be that many more than two.
Right.
And here's
what's not being told: are the people being put in these mass graves in New York identified or unidentified?
What I was told was those are people that they can't locate anybody to claim them.
But they know who they are.
I think they have possibly.
I think a lot of people have IDs, and I think also it's not necessarily about who's getting claimed. It's that a lot of people are poor.
Yeah.
And they're not going to, even if they know their grandma just died, they're not okay to get grandma proper funeral. Well, and if the state
One of the problems with the speed at which they're dying, I think, is and because they don't know what to do with the bodies necessarily, is they are like, you know, you need to claim the body of lost and found within 24 hours or it's getting shipped out.
Yeah.
Like, well, they don't have time. They don't have storage to hold them.
They need to talk to these people, and they need to say, hey, would you mind dying a little slower? Getting back up here, it'd be helpful if you can wait till next week, and then we'll have more room for you. You know. Some people are so rude. In New York, everybody's cutting in line.
They're so quick.
It's just so rude over there. It's always me first, you know?
It's been kind of weird for me just to kind of think about how many people do die regularly.
Yeah.
I mean, the good thing is car accidents are down, right?
So how many DUI accidents aren't happening right now? There's so many DUI deaths that aren't happening. In a weird way, this virus is actually making us like better people because like pollution is down.
Separate domestic violence. Yeah.
Down like across the board.
There's all kinds of things that people are eating more vegetables and spending more time at home with their families, and you know, like when all the meatpacking industry folds up because everybody's sick, it's not a concern as the meatpacking industry. You know, suddenly everybody's going to become a vegetarian. Our blood sugar is going to rationally going to equal out or whatever. I mean, people are starting to be better in all these ways. We're reading stories to our children, for God's sake. You know, like, what's going on? Like, the human race is actually doing some shit. And then the other thing is weird is that, like, we were blaming all of this stuff on TV, right? But people are watching more TV than they've ever watched before, and we're still being better people. It wasn't TV this whole time. It was capitalism.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, it wasn't TV, but yeah. School shootings are down.
School shootings. For like the first time in all this time, it's like, we're being so much better as people right now because of this thing.
Who's getting hurt? Like, who's hurting? Like, drug dealers are getting hurt, right? Because there's no kids at the playgrounds. No kids at the playground.
Burglars are suffering right now. They can't break in anywhere. Everybody's home.
Yeah.
If somebody on my next door site, somebody put like car stolen at so and so address, and I was like, "How'd you let your car get stolen?" That's on you. That's on you now. You're not going anywhere.
Also, if you really do, I mean, if you really want to fuck with somebody, you're going to steal the car. Just, you know, cough up some COVID all over the steering wheel, and they'll get it. You get the car, and you get something else with the motherfucker. Fuck you. You got it. It's like you can use it. You can use it as your own personal bio warfare now.
I do feel like people are friendlier when I am walking somewhere. Like you walk mm-hmm. by somebody, you know, they keep their distance, but they look at you like you're human. Like, hi.
Yeah.
We're live. We're doing it.
I think a lot of people are like, are you scared too? Are you also scared? Oh, stranger. I can see the fear in your eye. Yes. You're human.
People are friendlier. I feel like I see people thanking like grocery store workers a lot more, even though I've heard like a lot of them get crapped on now. Like people are mad, but I've heard mostly gratitude, but I've heard some bad stories that they're like, people are mean. Well,
here in San Antonio, it's a very distinct class lines by what part of the city you live in. If you live on the north side, you're rich. If you live on the south side, you're poor. And interestingly enough, man, a lot of the grocery stores that were reporting like people misbehaving was up north. Like all the hoarding was going on, people being mean to each other, people actually fighting over stuff. And down here on the south side, everybody's like, we're used to being poor. We're used to shit not going our way. Yeah. So fine. Yeah, you know?
People are already used to working with their neighbors to survive. When you take like, you know, working with your neighbors to survive up to the Hamptons, it doesn't check out so good. Like everybody up there, I can't work with my neighbor. Like, you know, I'm trying to keep up with them.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing though too is like we're seeing like a lot of people like are getting crap for, oh, why do you have so many people at your house kind of stuff, you know, on social media. And they're like, these motherfuckers all live here. What are you talking about? Where else are they?
Right. This is the tribe. These are the people that are here. Like, if one of us gets it, we're all getting it.
I have, you know, yeah, there's, I think there's a dichotomy because there's people are super friendly I see out, and I don't know who they, you know, why. But the amount of hoarding that has happened has taught me Walking Dead has got a lot correct, right? People are going to break off into their own factions, and they are very much, nah, I'm taking care of me first.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I'm like,
oh no, you gotta watch. You watch out for your own clan. You know,
I don't have your
own. So in the first 2 weeks, we've been doing call-in shopping. You go online and then you just pick up curbside pickup.
Yeah.
And so we've been doing period because you can only get X amount of food. So we've been doing, you know, we go two or three trips a week. And just get small stuff. It's kind of like, it's a weird kind of different way of shopping. And the first couple of weeks, we couldn't get eggs.
Yeah.
What the fuck, man? Eggs. Why are eggs the hardest thing?
Okay.
I have problems with teepee, but eggs, like there's no more eggs.
But so here's what happened though. So in the last week and a half, we had five separate orders, three at HEB and two at Whole Foods. And so we put eggs in every order. And in one day, in a 3 day period, I've got freaking eight sets of a dozen eggs in my refrigerator.
I'm jealous. I can eat four eggs a day. I put eggs in my breakfast. I put it in stir fry. The ultimate source of protein. And, you know, anybody who's like animal cruelty is a reason for being vegan should still eat eggs because that egg has not suffered at all.
Okay? Right.
Nothing fucking happened to that egg. It came out of a chicken's ass, which is probably the worst thing that can happen to you. And then that was it. That's all that happened to that egg. Being fried in my pan is probably a relief after that chicken ass. You know, at this point, I think the egg's life is getting better by me eating it.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm flour. I mean, flour suddenly was like, you all are not baking. You liars. You liars. Oh,
you bake. You bake. Fuck you. You bake. You never baked in your life.
Like, I need 3 bags of flour. Are you shitting me? Seriously.
How many people, though, are posting, like, videos of them making fresh pasta? Who the hell makes
fresh pasta? Why? I didn't go out and buy a lot of pasta. You know, my thing is, here's the thing, it's weird. It's like, I went out and bought all of my staples and the things that last a long time. I got enough rice in here that I could feed a whole village. I got enough pasta in here to feed a village. Right? But what I need is a fresh tomato. I need an onion.
Yeah.
You know, I need somebody to bring me an onion or a tomato or just a little bit of, you know, whatever is going to have to go with that stuff. I can survive. I have enough calories here. I can eat. Survive, but I do need that other stuff, and it's better if it's fresh. And that's, you know, I've seen these articles where they're talking about how farm, you know, migrant farm workers, people Trump are trying, you know, is trying to like throw out of the country all these illegal, quote unquote, illegal farm workers, and then they're like suddenly now they're like, you know, the mandatory, you know, high value workers. And I'm like, you fucking guys, these people have been here this whole time doing this work, the same work this whole time. White people don't want strawberries.
No.
Strawberries? You want a strawberry? You want a strawberry now that the apocalypse is happening, you want a strawberry? Yeah. Guess what? It's a Salvadorian's going to pick that thing for you.
You know? No, white people pick strawberries from their backyard. They take 4. And they put them on their granola.
From a victory garden, maybe.
like, I got this for my strawberry. I get 4 a year. I put them out here. I'm just doing my own work. I'm doing my own thing, you know? this is a... Okay, the last thing I didn't want to talk about, especially with Hector here. Okay, because you're as an artist. I do keep seeing memes around saying, okay, well, the truth of who we really needed was we didn't need billionaires. We didn't need tech companies. What we needed was the grocery workers. We needed the postal employees. These are essential workers. And they'll also even say, we didn't need actors. And I was like, you've been streaming so much. How is even in an apocalypse, are we not going to appreciate how much the arts plays into our, do you think people still do not associate the art building from theater and such into their into the movies? They don't understand there's a thing as art direction that you have to study and learn. Is that even now, are we still, do you think art is going to play a bigger role at all, or people are going to appreciate more, or are we done with it?
You know what? I think initially, I think that rhetoric of, well, see, these people weren't needed. Well, you know, we are, because you're right. The connection between what it is that we do and what we train our students to do is why you can sit on your couch and freaking binge 15 hours of a freaking television show. Who did that, right? We did that, the writers, the actors, the directors. And yet still there is the wanting to dismiss that as non-essential. And I think that proof positive of that is look at other countries, look at Germany, look at France, look at Spain, who's having a much harder time than even Italy is. And all of them put in immediate stimulus packages for artists.
Did they?
Because they're immediately. It was one of the first waves. And here, there's not even a thought to that. There's not a thought to that. There's not a thought to the fact that you have all these gig workers, and that's and the thing that it, the thing that I am seeing that a lot of people are appreciating is you do see like rich people, like the rich artists, understand that like New Orleans was one example. One of the I can't remember, one of the famous rappers from New Orleans gave $10 million for gig workers. And these are people who make their living. The only way they make their living is by gigging. They have a set here and a set there, or they play here. But as soon as all that's closed down, they have no source of income.
Yeah.
No.
There's a bunch of buskers in New Orleans.
Private citizens who are taking consideration of that and not the government. So that really shows the value that the government has for all these people and for how much they put into the economy even at the same time, you know?
Yeah. Well, the only complaint I saw from people about the stimulus package, I mean, there were some complaints, but the big one I heard was about the Kennedy Center getting money.
But why that bothers me? Why wouldn't they? Why wouldn't
when they're like, they should raise their own money? They should. Why are we giving money to that? And I'm like, but that employs thousands of people, thousands of artists to come through. No way to make money.
Just the people who seat people in the Kennedy Center is like a few hundred people. You know, popcorn and you know. I think actually also what really a lot of it comes down to is that when you look at the human race and where we've come from, there was a time when we were barely alive, living in some cold cave, all huddled around a fire with a saber-toothed tiger outside ready to eat us. And the only thing that got us through those cold winters was that somebody had a story to tell. Yep. It kept everybody going. The story of where we came from, of who we are, where we're going. And these are the same stories that we tell over and over as artists, you know, and we still need these stories, even though we live in houses and we have the internet and we have all this stuff. These stories are really important to us, and somebody has to tell these stories. And it's not important until it is, you know. Yeah, somebody goes out and gets the meat. Somebody's the hunter. Somebody's the gatherer. Somebody does that functional stuff, but somebody also has to tell the story when we're all sitting around together as a society. And, you know, Netflix is where we go and things like that now. But the arts are very important. People now, especially now when we're in a time of crisis, and people need that sense of comfort and they need to attach to something and they need to feel what it is to be human and who we are and what, you know, you feel attached and you want that reassurance of what it is that you are. You need those stories. You need somebody to tell you a story. Yeah. Dolly Parton's reading stories to children. The stories are important, and the people who tell stories are important. And to say that they're not is some—it is some bullshit, and they're not valuable until they are. And the old storytellers, the people who have made it in Hollywood, and the people who have made it, you know, in rap music or whatever, they recognize that. The people that are down in the trenches are still telling very important stories. I think they're giving back in that way, like you mentioned. But it's, you know, it's a fundamental aspect of what it is to be a human, what it is that we are. And I think, you know, in these times, it's hard to ignore that.
Well, again, yeah, you know, this time of crisis also solidifies your choice in your profession as well. I'm teaching a bunch of students who are in the arts, and to hear them tell the stories of not just the stories that mean something to us, but the stories of this inspired me to keep going. This inspired me to know that I'm doing the right thing. This allowed me to understand that what I do is more important than mere entertainment or just entertainment, that it is what makes us human. It is what connects us. When I have a bunch of kids who are scattered to the wind, who are all in the same choir class, and they meet for the first time in a Zoom meeting, and all of a sudden they're there and they're doing something together, even though they're apart. When the class was over, I had the faculty member call me, and she's just like, she was almost in tears. Nobody wanted to leave. Nobody wanted to leave. They all wanted to stay in this Zoom chat room indefinitely because it was their only connection to the world, and they were doing something together that mattered, right? And it's those minor, and then that allows people who have been through other things to tell their stories. This faculty member she was in New York during 9/11, and then was able to tell the story to her to her students of what they did when she was a student in New York in response to 9/11. And all of a sudden, it looked very similar to what they were doing. And all of a sudden, there's a connection to humans going through this immense tragedy, but finding a way to connect with one another in a meaningful way, even though they're not there face to face with one another, you know?
Yeah, that's why the arts are important. That's why it gives us that connection to ourselves. And I mean, not just like, you know, I don't mean that in like this esoteric way, like me connecting to me personally, but like, you know, connecting other people. And, you know, when we're feeling disconnected, that's when we need to have these things, these creations that people make. And yeah, it's a shame that, you know, there are people that are, you know, still feeling the artists have always felt disregarded, but I think even now, like now, even more so, it's that's happening.
Yeah,
I do remember a long time ago, Hector, you told me about why it's important for just somebody just to do it, because not that it doesn't even have to be good. Like you had somebody, you worked with someone who wrote some books and just got them out there.
Wait, right? Wait, is this, you just told me this, Silas. You told me this. Is that Hector the one who told you that?
Oh, about the book series?
About, yeah, and then like the executive who was like making the sales meeting, the sales.
I'm not sure.
The sales guy who like had the cheap sales material and they were all laughing at him.
Oh no! That was something else. That was a different one. But no, Hector, you had something like, "Hey, these are not the best books, but I did it," and somebody, you know, people aren't even craving the best, right? They're not crazy. You don't have to be Faulkner, you know. You don't have to tell some story, and somebody's gonna listen. Well,
you know, Silas, you just told me this so not too long ago.
Marketing material.
It doesn't have to be the Mona Lisa. Why don't you just go out and make something, show that to people? Don't make it the best. Just make it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I started my YouTube channel, and I've been getting a tremendous response from it so far. So
no, you should.
A lot of really positive feedback, and I'm enjoying it. And I've only done 3 episodes, but you know, I'm it's a fun project, and it's something that I can do during the quarantine. You know, it's an artistic outlet I have, and I've had some criticisms, but for the most part, people are responding to it well. And I credit your influence. You kind of kicked me in the butt a little bit with that, with this line that you're going on with now. That yeah, just go ahead and make it. Don't make it the best if you can't. You know, you don't wait till you have that. You know, super 70mm. You know, high resolution camera. Just shoot it on your phone if you have to.
I waited far too long to do all the stuff I love to do because I want.
But that's the thing is that you think back on everything that you've done.
Yeah.
And if you're doing it for the right reason, the process was always 100 times better than the product.
Oh,
right.
Yeah. Oh, I love. Oh, yeah. That. I love process.
So people ask me all the time. So I have this new job where I work 8 to 5 now. And I'm still directing. I still direct in my season. And my boss has no problem with the fact that I do it, but he wonders all the time. It's like, how do you do it? How are you here till 11 o'clock every night and still show up the next day and you're not burned out? It's impossible to make. He's a mathematician. Yeah. He's a math teacher. That's what he does. It's impossible to make him understand that the time that I spend in rehearsal gives me energy,
yeah,
revives me.
Yeah,
it doesn't take anything away from me. It actually gives me the energy that I need to go do this mundane job. And I love it. I love my job that I'm doing now, and I get different things out of it. But it's very different than the rush that I get from watching a kid, from saying something to a kid, giving a note to a kid, and having him go, "Oh shit, now I get it. Is this what you're talking about?" And then he does something and I'm like, "Yeah, that was it." And and the kid says, "How'd you do that?" And I was like, "I didn't do that. You did that. I just gave you the push to go there." That moment, that time that I spent in rehearsal gives me all the energy that I need to keep going. I can't imagine my life without having art in it. I would go nuts because then I would have nothing. It would be me giving and getting nothing, right? And that's what it does for me. So every semester I spend 6 weeks sleep deprived because I work from 8 to 5. I take an hour break for lunch, and then I'm in rehearsal from 6 to 10 or 6 to 11, depending on the schedule that I've set up, right? But none of that time is taken away from me. It's all giving back to me, right? So, and I have a wife that understands that for 6 weeks out of every semester, she's going to see very little of me because by the time I get home, my wife's asleep, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel that way about the orchids, like spring season. This season right now, it's just actually the season where I'm super busy because I'm planting up new seedlings and I'm going to all these orchid shows and new product is coming in that I'm setting up for next year with the stuff that I set up last year that's coming in this year is getting sold. So it's like this real intense like flux in the cycle, right? And decisions that I make for next year are actually like affected by what I'm doing this year in sales. If I'm having a real hot year and I'm selling a lot, I order more seedlings in. Now it's doubly busy. I'm turning and burning the shows, selling all my inventory. But then I have to like replant a whole bunch of new inventory for next year. And I get this energy from doing the work and like having, you know, this excitement that goes on for 6 years. And then now, like this year, a whole bunch of that's been kind of taken away because I can't go do the shows where, you know, that where the energy, a lot of the energy comes in. Because for me, some of it is the sale, but a lot of it is actually talking. I have Silas knows me comedy, but like I have actually like comedy jokes that are orchid jokes that are older than my comedy jokes. But one of them is that the only thing I love more than orchids is talking about orchids, which is true because I'll sit there all day and talk to these old grannies. I'll sell them orchids all day, but just talk about orchids all day long. I just love doing it, you know. And I don't get to do it this year. It's kind of sad.
Yeah,
I hope they figure it out so that we can have these shows again. You know, there's a lot of things that we do that we can't do right now that are little American traditions like going to a movie theater. We can't.
Oh my God.
We can't go to a theater right now. It's really a shame what we're losing by not being able to come together.
I've never been so pissed off that I can't pay $7 for 50 cents worth of soda. You know, I've never been that pissed off before. You know. And, you know, my wife will say, well, we'll make some popcorn. And it's just not the same. It's just not the same. But be in the theater and get gouged for all that money. It's just the.
I tell you what. Why don't you guys have a movie and then I'll come over and you can give me a soda and a really big cup and I will sneak some whiskey in my jacket and carry that soda. And we can watch a movie at your house. I'll eat a big thing of popcorn. I'll pay you $27.
There you go. That's it, man. That's all we need, man.
It'll make it more normal for me, you know?
Hey, we're out of time now.
I might even bring somebody I like and get a hand job.
All right, hey, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for coming on, Hector. Thank you for joining from San Antonio there. Appreciate it. This has been great talk. Joe, thanks for coming on again and being there.
Well, thank you for having me. Yes.
Alright. Black and a half. Live long and prosper.